Welcome back again. This is our final third talk given by Dr. Anthony Cerulli. He's coming to us from Hobart and William Smith College. That's like Geneva, right?
Yeah,
that's out in Geneva. He's joining us today. And it's really awesome to have him back here again. Today his discussion is up there, Buddhism and Buddha, and how basically Buddhism spread after Buddha in India. So, without further ado,
part of the story, yeah. Thanks for having me back. It's really nice to see you here again. I'm actually not as far away as Geneva. That's where I work, but I live in Pittsburgh. So this is closer to home than where my office is, in fact, or where
really
I teach.
Cool.
In preparing the talk for today, it dawned on me that when I spoke with Kathy and the other members of the steering committee about what I might be speaking, that this idea of what happens after the Buddha's gone is a great idea, a wonderful topic, an important topic. But as I started preparing it, right, we had those conversations in October, November of last year, and as I started preparing the talk for today, I realized that this is an enormous topic. And a student of mine just Friday said that she saw on the website for the Rochester Zen Center that I was giving a talk this Sunday, and she wanted to know what it was about. And it struck me at that moment when she asked me that it's about the last 16 weeks of the course she had just taken, all in a matter of an hour or a little less than an hour. And so the last 48 hours have been me trying to take this, what you're about to see up here, and just condense it. And what it becomes, or what it's become, is a kind of greatest hits of post-parinirvana, of Gautama's parinirvana. And I've tried my best to keep it in a kind of narrative. As you'll see, there'll be some things that I'll talk about in particular about these greatest hits that happen, most of which is in Asia, but I'll end outside of Asia, which is where we get the elsewhere here. And so, I guess with that intro, I'll get started. So if we're talking about Buddhism after the Buddha, we really, for me, in my mind, we need to start here. Rajagriha here, which is down here. This is on the map right here, and there's a little cutout of India, northeastern India. You can see Nepal right there, that little country right there. Those are the modern-day boundaries today. But pretty much the whole life of the Buddha, everything that he did, the lectures that he gave, the people that he met, and where he died and was born, and all of this business happened in this little region right here in the foothills of the Himalayas in present-day northeast India and Nepal. So if we talk about after the Buddha, he has his parinirvana, he's gone. We're talking about 5th century BCE, and scholars will debate about when in the 5th century BCE that the Buddha passed on. Some will put him at the beginning of the 5th century BCE, some will put him at the end. For us, I think it's fine just to say 5th century BCE right now, just to get a general idea. And I'll be talking in broad sweeps like this, broad century sweeps throughout this talk. So it happened here, it happened then, and the people who were there, in the same year that he died, was convened by a monk called Mahakashyapa, and two other important monks that were there were Ananda and Upali. And the texts say that there were about 500 monks. These were people who mostly knew the Buddha. They walked and talked and spent time with him. And it was important that they have a meeting immediately or as soon as possible after he died in order to bring together the things that he taught, in order to bring together the kinds of rules of conduct for the Sangha, to try and institutionalize the things that Gautama said and did so that they could perdure and persist after he's gone. And so what we find in this first meeting, it's called the First Buddhist Council, as we see the collection of the Pali Canon, or the three baskets. And the word for that, or the title, is Tripitaka. And in those three baskets, you get the Sutra basket, the sayings of the Buddha. You get the Vinaya basket, which is the code of conduct for monks and nuns primarily, but also for a lay community. And then there's the Abhidharma Pitaka, which is the higher dharma, this sort of philosophical and psychological interpretation of the sayings of the Buddha. That's really amorphous at this stage. It starts to develop for the next 400 or 500 years after, and then it starts to become more crystallized, the third basket. what you see in each of the beginnings of the Sutra Pitaka, the sayings of the Buddha at this meeting, is you hear this intro, evam me sutam, thus I have heard. And that's because, of course, what's being collected at this time are sayings that people who have spent time with the Buddha are bringing together and saying, well, excuse me, thus I have heard that the Buddha, the Blessed One, spent time in Vaishali, and he said this to the monks and nuns living there, and so on and so forth. And so the three baskets are collected in this way of people remembering things that the Buddha did and said. Yeah.
You're saying three baskets, but this isn't being written down yet, is it?
Mm-mm. It won't be written down until the first century of the Common Era. So it'll be transmitted orally for roughly four centuries, quite a while. Legend has it that Ananda recalled everything the Buddha ever said. And so he's the one who supplies pretty much all of the information in the Sutra Pitaka. And Upali recalled everything the Buddha ever did. And so he's the one who supplies all the information that goes into the Code of Conduct, the second basket, the Vinaya Pitaka. This becomes critical, the Pali Canon or the three baskets, for what becomes Theravada Buddhism throughout Southeast Asia. Now here's a map, confusing perhaps at first blush, but it's some of the stuff I'll be talking about today. After that first Buddhist council, things in the Buddhist community throughout Asia start changing because Buddhism and Buddhist practitioners start traveling widely throughout the region. So here's that little map we saw on the last slide. This is where that dot is right here. And from there, from where the Buddha spent his life, Buddhism travels in these directions. You can see it goes as far west as Afghanistan on this map, and it even goes further very early on as far as what we, the Mediterranean, that area, thanks to an important Indian king, whom I'll talk about in just a moment. Of course, it goes out throughout India, and then down through Southeast Asia, all the way down into Java, Sumatra and Java, or Indonesia, which incidentally happens to be where I first encountered some of the basic ideas of Buddhism, was Indonesia, not in India, and then into China, into Korea, and off to Japan. And what I'll try to be using to tie these various travels of Buddhist practitioners and their ideas, tie them together, is this notion of cultural negotiation. So when Buddhist practitioners leave the sort of heartland of where the Buddha was in Northeast India, what do they encounter when they go to China? What do they encounter when they go to Japan? And so on and so forth. Because when they arrive, there are other ideological systems, or religions, if we want to use that term, that already exist there. And so there's a process of negotiation about their various ideas, views, and so on and so forth. So there'll be ideological and practical compatibility that allows Buddhism to actually find a home in China, Japan, and Sri Lanka, and so on and so forth. And political patronage is going to be a running theme. Did the politicians, or did the government accept Buddhism? And in fact, support it and prop it up. That becomes a very critical point in the history of Buddhism and allows it to stay and then spread. So when we talk about political patronage, it starts very early in India. It starts with this king right here, King Ashoka. He was the grandson of a Mauryan Empire king named Chandragupta, and he inherited the kingdom in Pataliputra, which is in that same little area where the Buddha lived. He lived in the 3rd century BCE. And here you see a map of his grandfather's kingdom, the blue part right here. Here's Pataliputra right here in the foothills of the Himalayas in Nepal. And then you see the purple areas, what Ashoka expanded his grandfather's kingdom quite widely. All of India, pretty much, with the exception of the southern part of the peninsula, up into Afghanistan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and bordering up here into the areas of China and into the Himalayas. About 8 years after he becomes king, Ashoka apparently has a conversion experience, like Paul on the road to Damascus kind of thing. He's in a battle in an area called Kalinga, which is down here, would be on this map down here, and he's struck by this battle. He's been leading lots of battles, you know, throughout these 8 years as king, and probably with his father and grandfather before as a young soldier. But he's in Kalinga and he sees just the decimation of all sorts of people, men, women, and children. And he writes about this, or rather he has somebody write about it for him, and he's struck at that battle, at the bloodshed that he was responsible for causing. A lot of people who he thought didn't deserve to lose their lives. a lot of people who were displaced from their homes as a result of this battle in Kalinga. And he has a kind of conversion, or a moment in which he stops, he realizes that he's in charge of the decimation of people's lives or their opportunities, or the splitting of families and so on and so forth, and just causing lots of pain. And he suddenly stops the sort of path he had been following, the path that his grandfather, Chandragupta, also followed, and he decides to take on a very different approach to being a king in India. He records all of these things on what are referred to as the Edicts of Ashoka. And these are carvings right here. The script is not Sanskrit, it's called Brahmi script. And they're carved in these pillars, these big stone pillars. Some are on rock walls and some are in caves. And he basically has people record first his conversion experience, what he saw in Kalinga and why it affected him the way he did. And then he starts talking about the various socio-moral precepts of Buddhism as the new sort of path he wants to take as a king. And then he also describes some of the missionary activity that he starts sending out envoys throughout the world. He describes his rulership as Dharma rule, ruling by Dharma, not by the sword any longer, but it's ruling by Dharma. And he calls his winning over of territories his Dharma conquest. You'll win over more land if you teach people about the Dharma and have them voluntarily join you because they're convinced by the rigors and the importance and the compassion nature of the Buddha's Dharma. And on these edicts, we see that Dharma rule is characterized by committing few sins, performing deeds of kindness and liberality and truthfulness. And he also is a huge proponent of ahimsa. And so he also went wherever throughout his territory, we see him instituting things like hospitals for animals of all sorts too, which was a very striking change in his promotion of his rulership. So here's a big Ashokan pillar. These are all the places throughout India where you find them. And they go again. Here's Kandahar, so we're up in what is contemporary Afghanistan, throughout most of South Asia. Well, can't see the map. There is a map of Asia behind there. It's very washed out, unfortunately. Ashoka around 250 BCE actually calls a third Buddhist council. There's one after the first one we talked. The second, and then he calls a third one in 250 BCE, in his headquarters of Pataliputra. And at that time, he sends two people down to Sri Lanka, which is where this arrow is pointing to down there. It's the big island south of India. Mahinda and Sanghamitta, these are his son and his daughter, and they found the Buddhist Sangha in Sri Lanka. And so this is his first really big press forth out of that little heartland area, to consciously start a brand new sangha in a place where there hadn't been one before. This map, and incidentally, the king of Sri Lanka at the time, his name is Tissa. King Tissa gladly accepts them, opens up the doors to Buddhism, makes it the state religion in Sri Lanka, and moves the headquarters to a new place called Anuradhapura, which would be Happy Town, or the Town of Happiness, or something like that. And that becomes the headquarters of his Buddhist empire. Very fitting, I think. This map here then shows how Ashoka's missionary activity to spread Buddhism expands well beyond where he was located. So you can see it goes all the way over to the Mediterranean over here, Bactria over here, Tarim Basin, which is in China, here, in southeast into Burma and in Sri Lanka. The success, as we'll see, of Buddhism to take root in all these places is variable. So you don't find it taking root over here as much as you do over here, but it's important that it spreads that way. There are various sorts of exchanges and reasons for the ability of this exchange, as we'll see, that start to evolve because of economic ties that are allowed across this great span of space from here all the way over to Japan, in fact, which comes about a century after Ashoka. So while Ashoka is doing this missionary activity in South Asia, so in the countries that we today call Sri Lanka, India, Bhutan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, the Maldives, there are about 18, most scholars recognize 18 early Buddhist schools. So after the Buddha, various Buddhist communities start questioning how you should interpret and implement the sutras of the Buddha, what he said. There's disagreement, naturally. Right? The intent of that first Buddhist council was to try and avoid too much disagreement, but early on there's quite a bit of disagreement. Out of the early 18 schools, only one survives to this very day, and that's Theravada. It's the way of the elders. It's the only surviving of those original schools, and that's the Buddhist tradition that we see pervading almost all of Southeast Asia. So here's another map. This shows the spread of Buddhism. It's more confusing than the last one I showed you. But it's important, I think, and somewhat useful, because you can see the difference of the different types of Buddhism as they spread from the heartland of where the Buddha lived, which is this oval shape right here. The green arrows that you see are the spread of Theravada Buddhism. And so you can see how they primarily just go into Southeast Asia in this way. The red arrows are Mahayana, and that's going to go up into the north and all the way to the Far East, and a little bit down into Southeast Asia, as well as down into Indonesia. But if you can actually see the variety of the dark and the lighter shades, where the lighter shades are, so up here, most of India, here, and then down here, this is where Buddhism didn't stay for very long. The dark areas where Buddhism took root and still to this very day you find as the predominant religion. When we talk about Southeast Asia, which is where I want to just still stay for a moment, we talk about the Indianization of this area. From the time of Ashoka till roughly the 12th century, various waves of Hindu and Buddhist, sometimes together, missionary activity goes down all the way into Indonesia. And this is referred to usually as the Indianization of Southeast Asia. So if you go to temples in Cambodia, if you go to a temple in Burma, or even in Indonesia, if you can still find Buddhist temples, and you can, not many, because it's primarily, it is very much a Muslim nation now, you'll see Sanskrit. You'll see, it looks like Indian architecture. You'll see the influence of India throughout most of these areas. Same goes for both Hindu and Buddhist areas in Southeast Asia. So now this broad swath of time, 100 to 750 CE, Buddhism enjoys a comfortable place in South Asia, in India. But it is coincides, this period, with what's referred to as the Hindu Renaissance. So Buddhism, because of Ashoka, gained a lot of converts across India. And this didn't go unnoticed to the prevailing Hindu authorities, folks who had power in the Hindu communities, which was the primary community in India. And so they recognize that they need to try and see what is bringing people to convert to Buddhism and perhaps leave Hinduism, or what are we doing that they're not doing? And one of the things, just generally, is that they realize that Buddhism is very open and allowing people to have access to religious practice and to the religion, to the ideas, in a way that Hinduism wasn't. Hinduism was radically built upon and structured according to a strict social strata, four classes in society. The higher up in the strata that you were, the more access you had to religious practice. The more access to religious practice that you have, more spiritual opportunities are available to you. Right? And these went all the way through society down to the jobs that you do. So the Hindu Renaissance recognizes a time for the Hindu community in India, primarily, when bhakti, or devotional Hinduism, starts becoming popular, which is something that you didn't have to be part of the high class of society to do, to practice Hinduism. It opened up Hinduism to a broader group of people, bringing women into the fold of religious practice as well, which they were denied earlier on. So from this period, 100 to 750 CE, Hinduism and Buddhism are both experiencing a relatively pleasant time in India. Not a lot of animosity, but Hinduism is responding to the success of Buddhism at the time and opening its doors. And so the political patronage will vary. It will be Buddhist at one time, and it will go to a Hindu patron, and so on and so forth, kind of in waves. Until about 750, and then from 750 to 1175, we see a very strong Buddhist empire called the Pala dynasty. And this would be, in India, the last Buddhist empire in India. The Muslims arrive in force. They've been here before this period, but in 1206, what's referred to as the Delhi Sultanate, this is the location of Delhi in India, North India, where the Sultan made his headquarters. It's called the Delhi Sultanate. It was in 1206. And with 1206, India would become a Muslim ruled area for a very, very long time, and for all intents and purposes, most scholars recognize the beginning of the 13th century or the end of the 12th century is when Buddhism, for all intents and purposes, is gone from India. Whether it was because the Muslims arrived and sort of pushed them out, or there are other reasons, is a point of great debate for a lot of people. In the area, though, Sri Lanka maintained a very strong Buddhist nation, despite the fact. So if I go back to this last map, actually, you'll see even that when the Muslims arrived, they very often didn't have control of the southern tip in the same sort of way they did across the north and the middle part of India. So we see that Sri Lanka is able to maintain, in a lot of ways, its Buddhist state sponsorship. There's an interesting period, I think, that's worth mentioning, which I'm going to talk about now, which is in the early 11th century, is that this part of India right here is called Tamil Nadu, so the state of Tamil Nadu. You refer to the people from Tamil Nadu as Tamils, and their language is also Tamil. And the religious practitioners in the 11th century were Hindus. So in the early 11th century, some Hindu Tamils invade Sri Lanka, and they take over Sri Lanka and kick out and destroy a lot of the Buddhist temples and so on, and try and kick out a lot of Buddhist practitioners. It doesn't last very long. And interestingly enough, the Hindu Tamil and the Buddhist Sri Lankan animosity has been going on for a long, long time, predating even the 11th century, and it lasting officially until 2009, when the battles between the Hindu Tamils and the Sri Lankan Buddhists was supposed to have stopped. But I think if you still go there, you'll see some troubles. But in any case, by the late 11th century, with the aid of the Burmese Buddhist kingdom, the Buddhist Sri Lankan king, Vijayabahu, was able to drive the Hindu Tamils out of Sri Lanka and reestablish the Buddhist kingdom. So there's about a 75-year period in which Sri Lanka is overtaken by Hindus, becomes a Hindu island, but then they're driven back out, becomes Buddhist again. And so we see that King Vijayabahu, after he kicks out the Hindu Tamils, he's able to make Buddhism prominent again on the island. And so to whom do you suppose he turns to for help to try and reestablish Buddhism on the island?
The king's son and daughter?
Ashoka's?
Yeah.
This is a while after.
Yeah. Oh,
okay. So he looks to the folks who helped him drive out the Hindu Tamils, so the Burmese Buddhist community. And so the interesting point about this is not simply that there were help from other Buddhist communities to kick them out, but when he looks to the Buddhist community of Burma to reestablish Buddhism in Sri Lanka, we see that afterward there are no more nuns in the Sangha in Sri Lanka. Had he been able to look to Ashoka's son and daughter, there would have been nuns, because they go down and they start an order of monks and nuns. But in Burma at the time, there were no nuns in the order. And so the model becomes the Burmese model for Sri Lanka. And ever since the 11th century, because of this little war between the Hindu Tamils and the Buddhist Sri Lankans, the Sri Lankan Buddhists, there have not been nuns to this very day in Sri Lankan Buddhism. What you have in Burma is this. You have this order, and put that in quotes, called the Tilashin. These are holders of morality, if you translate it literally. There are women who take almost all of the precepts that a monk or nun would take in the Theravada monastic order in the Burmese Sangha, but they're not recognized by the monks of the Sangha as actually being part of the monastic order. They may take almost all of the same sort of vows, but they're not given the same sort of recognition in society. And yet they don't see themselves as equal to the basic lay community in society either. And so they sort of live in a kind of limbo between the lay and the monastic order.
Are they? Do they receive much financial support? Like, I'm guessing they would go out begging for food, and maybe financial is the wrong word, but are they? Do they receive enough support with that?
They go out and they do beg for their food like the monks do, but interestingly enough, they get, and here you see them with their begging bowls, in fact, they get different kinds of gifts in return because the people don't recognize them as actual monastics in the same sort of way that they do recognize the monks. And so people will give them money, whereas they wouldn't give, they would just give food to a monk or something like this, because monks shouldn't be handling money according to the Pali Canon. And so their treatment's very strange, and some people, some very good ethnographers have been writing about the way in which they view themselves and the way in which society sort of views them. And it's, I think, an interesting and, for them, a problematic situation. And I don't know what sorts of future there is or if it will change or not.
What do we know about the Tamils' treatment of Buddhist nuns? Were they singled out when they took over Sri Lanka?
Over against the monks, and as far as I know, I think it was a pretty uniform, I don't know if decimation's too big of a word, but monasteries were just destroyed flatly, and lots of people were persecuted, whether they were men or women Buddhist practitioners. Moving on, again, as I said, we're covering big areas. We'll move into other parts of Asia, and we look at other parts of Asia. So that was India, South Asia, Sri Lanka's down here, and Southeast Asia. We talk about North, Central, and East Asia. We're talking about Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism. So we have Buddhism in China. Buddhism in China basically starts to enter, most scholars recognize it as about 100 BCE. And the evidence for this arrival of Buddhism in China around 100 BCE, does anybody have any guesses as to what sorts of evidence we might have, where it might come from, what discipline?
Like shipping or maybe some kind of shipping economic, it would be, like records of people coming in and going with trade, I would imagine.
Yeah, can you think of maybe the trade or the shipping of what kinds of things? Because it's something pretty particular that...
Tea.
Tea?
That would be output. Yeah.
Well,
that wouldn't be input as much.
So there is tea in northern India that could have gone in. That's good. This is something else, something that you don't consume in the same way you consume with your eyes.
No.
With your eyes, yeah.
Oh, paint?
Well, paintings or artwork, sculptures. So art historians are the ones who give us the earliest evidence that we have that Buddhism's arriving in China around this time in 100 BCE. And again, it's a succession of negotiations. So the two big traditions in China at this time are Confucianism and Taoism. And so when the Buddhists arrive in India, their first conversations in terms of the sorts of ideas that they're promoting or that they're sharing for whatever reason are with people who belong to these two traditions, and often they belong to these traditions at the same time. And after Buddhism actually arrives and stays in China, you hear the phrase the three teachings. And so the three teachings are Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and they often work in a very compatible sort of way. At times, in order for Buddhism to make itself intelligible to Confucian and Taoist practitioners, Buddhists had to adopt the terminologies of these two traditions. And so you have Buddhist texts in China talking about the Tao. You have references to things like filial piety, which is a Confucian concept. And there are lots of struggles for scholars of Chinese classical Chinese religious texts to try and parse through who's the Buddhist, who's the Taoist, who's the Confucian, which may be a meaningless task at the end of the day because they sort of syncretize all of them in a lot of people's lives. But because they're adopting the terminology of one another, it becomes very sort of murky. A couple things that were very important for Buddhism's expansion into China. First thing is the fall of the Han Dynasty is really one of the major things that helps Buddhism find a place to take root. It took a while in China for Buddhism to become established, much, much longer, say, compared to Japan, where it happened fairly quickly, if we compare the two. So around 100 BCE, we start getting our historical evidence that Buddhism is in China, and that's during this Han Dynasty. And this is a Confucian-sponsored state, primarily. And it's after the fall of the Han Dynasty when we see Buddhism start taking off and actually becoming something that political patrons adopt and try and promote in China. Another thing that's very important, and this is very economic, this is a reason, is that also around this time, before at least the end of the Han, in India or in South Asia, we have an empire called the Kushan Empire. It's across a lot of the north here and stretched around the Himalayas all the way up into here, into parts of China. The Kushan Empire was a primarily Buddhist empire in North India between the centuries of the 1st and 3rd centuries of the Common Era. And it was situated at such a spot. So here we've got here stretching up into here, or on this map, let's see, here stretching up into here. It was situated on such a spot during the Han Dynasty where it made it a pivotal location for what you see here, these lines. It's kind of in the center of all of these networks right here. Does anybody know what these networks are?
Silk Road.
Exactly, yeah, the Silk Road. And so the Silk Road, right, these are networks of trading, economic route, not just the trading of goods and things, but ideas as well. And so it was a very important spot. As Buddhists traveled north out of India, up here, they became exposed to a variety of different things, including the various ideologies and religious practitioners of China, as far west, excuse me, east as Korea and Japan, and as far west this direction to the Mediterranean. And the blue lines here are maritime routes. So road is a bit of a misnomer. It's actually a network, right? I just use the one word road often as the way it's referred to. It's actually a Silk Road trading network or roads. It's around this time also when we start getting this distinction, Mahayana versus Hinayana. So thanks to things like the Silk Road, thanks to the Kushan Empire, when Buddhists were traveling through these areas and interacting with other people from throughout the world, as Buddhist practitioners moved north, what in the Kushan Empire was originally a kind of conservative Buddhism by most standards, as it moved north and interacted through economic trade, through the movement of religious ideas and texts and so on, into the north, this great sort of cosmopolitan experience for Buddhist practitioners opened up really their ideas to what are, you know, Mahayana or greater sorts of things than they had been practicing in India at the time, which were basically close, strict adherence to the Pali Canon, to those three baskets that we talked about or that I talked about just about 15, 20 minutes ago. And so we get, this is from a newspaper in Burma, you get this smaller and greater vehicles. And of course, I'll just remind you before I say something about this, is that Mahayana practitioners gave themselves that notion that they were practitioners of the greater vehicle. And I think it's important to talk about it as a comparative because they were not just great, but greater. They were purposefully naming themselves in opposition to those early 18 Buddhist schools, of which Theravada is the only one that persists today. And they called those schools, the Mahayana practitioners called them Hinayana. This was not something a Theravada practitioner would say, I belong to the vehicle of the smaller vehicle or Hinayana vehicle. This is what the Mahayana practitioners referred to them as. And this cartoon here reflects the reason why. As Mahayana goes up north, especially on this sort of very cosmopolitan, this great intellectual cultural exchange network of the Silk Road, practitioners were learning all sorts of new things and realizing that one can practice the Buddha's Dharma in a variety of ways, perhaps. And so it becomes greater in that sense. It's not simply restricted to what you find in those three baskets. And one thing in particular for these practitioners whose ideas emerge as a bit greater in that sense, I'm using that word loosely, is that Buddhism could be open to more people in a way that Theravada, at least so they saw it, was not allowing, right? And this is what this cartoon refers to. So because the path to Nirvana it offers, it being Theravada, is so restrictive and accessible to few, Theravada is referred to as the small vehicle. The people who are in this car are a small group of people. The paradigmatic figure is called an arhat, a worthy one. This is not a group of people that most Buddhists in the Theravada community are going to be able to become. In Buddhism, this great big bus is a different sort of thing. It's driven by a bodhisattva, somebody who's not going to go on and take nirvana, like the arhat will, until everybody can get on board this bus and you all drive off together. It's much more inclusive in that way. There are many other things where you can see a kind of criticism of Theravada, that make these distinctions even more clear. But that's the primary one. What is the central figure? In Mahayana, it's this notion of a bodhisattva, somebody who's all compassionate and making sure that everybody can have the same access. And you're not going to take that path toward nirvana until you make yourself available to everybody else and allow them to have the same opportunity. Whereas they saw Theravada's emphasis on this notion of becoming an arhat as being a bit less compassionate and perhaps not as inclusive, and therefore it's a little sports car or whatever.
Anthony, is it true that Theravada was monks and Mahayana becomes more lay people? Or is that too coarse of a...
You've got both in both. So you have the lay community in both Mahayana and in Theravada too. But the monk community and the nuns, when there were nuns in Theravada or in those early schools, the conservative schools, have the greater capacity to be the ones driving this car than the lay community.
You know, it's interesting, it occurs to me, that the Theravada school seems to resemble institutionally the separation that existed in Hinduism between the Brahmins and the other castes.
Yeah, that's a nice point. That's a nice point, and it's growing up out of that Hindu community. Even though, which is an interesting thing to note, given what you just said, is that the Buddha was rejecting that, mm-hmm. right? And that's what made him such a revolutionary and drew people to his ideas and his teachings. But you know, it's a cultural product too,
right?
In a lot of ways. And he was traveling in a very small community, and so what opens up the doors, what throws them open, which makes the factory bigger to build these cars, right? Is the interaction that you see, through a kind of, intercultural, cross-cultural exchanges through things like the economic means of the Silk Road and through the promotion of missionary activity because of political patronage and so on, that the Buddha didn't have in his time. Now I'll jump to Tibet. Another important place for Buddhism is that Buddhism arrives in Tibet, by most accounts, the 8th century, when the arrival of a Indian tantric master named Padmasambhava, known as Guru Rinpoche, or called Precious Guru, this means, when he arrives up in Tibet. And legend has it that he arrives in the 8th century and he subdues all of the indigenous religious practitioners, all of the spirits and the divinities and so on that live in Tibet at the time, and converts them all to the Buddha's Dharma. The tradition that was there before Buddhism arrives is a tradition called Bon, and here are some Bon practitioners dancing and playing some instruments. After Padmasambhava comes and subdues most of the Tibetan population and converts them to Buddhism, most of the Tibetan kings start promoting Buddhism as the religion of their state, of their areas. And in some cases, Bon practitioners are persecuted if they don't convert. This lasts for about 3 centuries, maybe 2 centuries, 2.5 centuries, until around the 10th century, when Bon has a sort of resurgence in Tibet, and it emerges as a kind of sibling of Buddhism. In a lot of ways, from the 10th century on, it almost looks as though it's another form of Buddhism. It's always living in the shadow of Buddhism in a lot of ways, and they're incorporating things from one another, and they, to this very day, they subsist independently and simultaneously in conjunction at the same time. But it looks very much like Buddhism today.
Is it the same sort of relationship as Zen and Shinto?
It's a good question. Shinto and Buddhism, at least in the various forms of Buddhism in Japan, exist in similar sort of ways. You can be Bon, you can practice Bon and Buddhism in Tibet simultaneously, as you can practice via a Shinto practitioner and a Zen practitioner, or a Pure Land practitioner, or another form of Buddhism in Japan. In Japan, and with the Meiji Restoration, there was a conscious effort to separate the two for national reasons, to note which one's the indigenous tradition and which one's the later arrival or one that comes from the outside. And so That's a political reason. For most folks, I would think that you can do them both simultaneously, but politicians have had their sort of efforts in Japan to try and separate and distinguish the two in modern times in a way that I don't think you see in Tibet. They have their other political issues in Tibet that cause lots of problems with practice too, but not in that same sort of way. So Buddhism in Tibet ends up taking on four major strains. Perhaps some of you are well aware of these already. I'll just go through them quickly. We refer to two red hat schools. You often refer to them by their hats. Here, a Nyingma, a lama being teacher. It's a Tibetan translation of guru, which is the Sanskrit word meaning spiritual teacher. So you've got the Nyingma and the Sakya, red hat schools. And you have a black hat school, and with a few red hats too, because they're not simply just black hat school. In this case, that's called Kagyu school. The Karmapa is the leader of this school. Maybe if you're familiar with Tibetan Buddhism, you probably know a little bit about the Karmapa. And then the most famous is the yellow hat school, the most well-known. It's the largest of the four schools. This is the Gelug, or Gelug. You see that spelled with a K or a G in this case. And this is most well-known not only because it's the largest, but it's because the school to which the Dalai Lama belongs. So I think American headquarters is the Namgyo Monastery in Ithaca, not far from here. So, and they just finished building a huge new monastery, temple, place for monks to live. And I believe this is where, when he gets a chance, when he's around, this is where the Dalai Lama stays, there in Ithaca. So one thing about cultural negotiations in Buddhism, and particularly political patronage, is important to the institution of the Dalai Lama, where this came about. So I'm quickly going to try and tell you that story. The first Dalai Lama, Gendun Drupa, and the second one, Gendun Gyatso, were retroactively called the Dalai Lama. They were given the title after they had already passed away. And the reason for that is this. It's tied to Tibetan and Mongolian alliances. And we need to go back to the early 13th century in the Mongol Empire to understand how these alliances came about. Mongol Empire, of course, founded by Genghis Khan. It wasn't Genghis who started this alliance, however. It was his grandson, Kublai Khan, who was the fifth king in the Mongol Empire, and he lived in the most of the 13th century. He was the founder of what becomes the Yuan dynasty in Chinese history, which is humongous in terms of the territory that it covered in Chinese history, but pretty short-lived in terms of the length of time for which a dynasty in Chinese history lasts. It was not a very long one, but it was huge in terms of the territory that it covered. So Kublai Khan, in order to sort of shore up his power, in order to shore up his legitimacy as a ruler of this great expansive Yuan dynasty in China, looks for someone to help legitimate his position. And he reaches out to what were known as famous Tibetan monks, Buddhist monks at this time, and he reaches to a Sakya, someone from the Sakya order, which is one of the red hat schools, to come up and teach him about Buddhism and to teach some of the people in his territories about Buddhism. The monk's name is Phagpa that he invites. And Phagpa, while he's up there, he teaches Kublai Khan about Buddhism, converts him, converts a lot of people, people recognize the importance of Buddhism while he's there, and Phagpa declares that Kublai Khan is an incarnation of the Bodhisattva Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. Not only that, and he does what Kublai Khan was really looking for, the recognition as an incarnation of Manjushri is helpful, but he was really looking for this. He declares him to be a universal monarch. This is a Chakravartin is the word, and this is a very heavy, heavy important term in Asia, not just at this time, but for centuries prior to this too. And with that, what we see is the sort of solidification of what's called the patron and priest relationship in Asia. So the patron, in this case, is Kublai Khan, and the priest is the Sakya monk Phagpa. And the alliances that Kublai Khan will ensure the protection of the Tibetan Buddhist monks for as long as they're together like this, and Phagpa will ensure the spiritual legitimacy and appropriateness of his position as a world universal monarch in this case, ruling over all this territory of the Yuan dynasty. And most of the stories about this relationship are that whenever there was a matter of religious importance going on, Phagpa would sit in a throne slightly higher than Kublai Khan. And anything in political, in the realm of politics, they would reverse those roles. And so you can see not only is Kublai Khan benefiting from this, but the Sakya order and Tibetan Buddhist monks are also gaining great political power, at least recognition, as well. They're mutually beneficial, this patron-priest relationship. Yuan dynasty doesn't last very long, unfortunately for them, and they're kicked out. The Mongols are kicked out in 1368, and the Mongols go back to Mongolia, to the steep lands of Mongolia, and for about two centuries, Mongolia is fragmented and ruled by a bunch of tribal chieftains. It's sort of, tribal chieftain here and there and so on and so forth, and a lot of them are battling. Until the 16th century, when imperial ambitions reignite with Altan Khan, his name right here, 1577, who's been hearing the stories of his ancestor Kublai Khan, and he has the same sort of aspirations that he had. And so he says, if I'm going to ever gain the same sort of pride of place that Kublai had, I should probably do some of the same things that he did. And so he looks to Tibet. He looks for a Buddhist practitioner to sort of anoint him publicly as an important spiritual and political leader. So he goes to the Namgyal Monastery in Tibet, and he finds a very famous, at the time, Buddhist monk named Sonam Gyatso. And he invites him up. And so Altan Khan invites Sonam Gyatso up. He comes up and he teaches Buddhism in the same sort of way that Phagpa did with Kublai Khan. So here's the range we're talking about. Here's Tibet, here's Mongolia up here. When Kublai Khan had established the Yuan dynasty, it covered all of this area. Really, it was enormous. Sonam Gyatso, while he's there, just in a similar sort of way that Phagpa said that Kublai was the incarnation of Manjushri, Sonam Gyatso says, I am, in fact, an incarnation of the Sakya monk Phagpa, and Altan Khan is an incarnation of the former Mongolian emperor Kublai Khan. Why? Because we're here to spread Buddhism. It has nothing to do with the priest-patron relationship, which we all know was established with that last order between these two. But they use this sort of notion that it's important that we recognize this lineage, right, and this connection, so that we can make the Buddha's Dharma important here again, at least in this area. Not nearly in the same expanse as the Yuan dynasty, but we can at least start moving in that direction. So where do we get Dalai? Still haven't heard that part yet. Altan Khan, while he's here working with Sonam Gyatso, bestows the title of Dalai to his Lama, to his teacher, right, and changing Gyatso Lama to Dalai Lama. Dalai is simply a Mongolian translation of the word Gyatso, which means ocean. Right? And so this is where we get the name for the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama simply, very literally, means ocean teacher. Now this has been interpreted to mean a whole bunch of different things by people, as the Dalai Lama is somebody whose teachings and knowledge is as vast and deep as the ocean. But very literally, it's simply just a translation from into Mongolian of the Tibetan name, which means ocean. And so I think, if you read conservative explanations as to what this name means, Dalai Lama, they probably would say, I don't know about this notion that it's about his understanding and knowledge being as deep and as vast as the ocean. It's simply, this is what his name was translated from Tibetan into Mongolian. Japan? Here's a map of Japan, all the way down in the east. And here we get. So when Japanese practitioners start arriving in Japan, this is the tradition that is recognized as being there, indigenous to the area, Shinto. Shinto, the word itself simply means shin, spirits, to, way. So way of the spirits, reading it backwards, is what the word translates into. And this was a term that the people who were in Japan prior to the arrival of Buddhism wouldn't have used themselves. This was a term that Buddhist practitioners applied to the people that they encountered when they got there, so that they could differentiate the spirits they're talking about from the gods and the divinities that Buddhists were talking about that exist in the various heavens that go back to Sanskrit-based texts and names and so on that are living in the Buddhist heavens and the celestial worlds. These are some Shinto things. If you've been to Japan, you've maybe seen these things. This is a very important Shinto piece of architecture. It's called a torii gate. It's a gate that you literally recognizes or marks the threshold moving from profane into sacred space. Here is a Shinto shrine. There's a little torii up here. It's kind of washed out on there. And it's recognizing, again, this sort of marking off of sacred space. Shinto is very embedded in the natural world, and there's a recognition that there are very spirits that inhabit this natural world and also inhabit the world in which we live. The spirits are called kami, K-A-M-I. I always ask my students if they'd ever heard of kami before, and most say no. Has anybody in here heard of kami before?
Kamikaze.
What's that?
Kamikaze.
Kamikaze. My students are surprised to learn that they did actually know there was a relationship with the kami in their lives because very famous toy or cartoon is supposed to have been based on the kami, and that's Pokemon. If you'd ever heard of Pokemon, it's Pikachu.
Sorry.
You know, you're right. And that's who that is. He's the most famous, I think. And these were adapted from this notion of the kami as having various characteristics that are embedded in nature. And in any case, they aren't pictured like this. This is just the Pokemon. So Buddhism in Japan is usually recognized as coming in the 6th century, mid-6th century, via Korea. That said, I think it's fair to say there were probably communities of Korean and Buddhists living in Japan prior to the mid-6th century, but most folks, most general sort of studies will say it was the mid-6th century. And the person that helped facilitate the movement of Buddhism into China and actually to make it stay was a person named Prince Shotoku. He's the one who made it a state religion, the one who made people sort of notice it by building various Buddhist temples and architectural things that made it visible to people. But he's also, very importantly, the one who made the first constitution of Japan, and in where he's recognized as the first architect of the first Japanese constitution, in which it encourages people to take refuge in the three jewels. And this is a very profound and important moment for Buddhism in Japan, for a lot of people to see the seriousness with which at least the political leaders and rulers were recognizing this new religion. He always allowed, though, this is one thing you still see a heavy hand or heavy influence of China in Japanese Buddhism because of Shotoku's reliance on China to help promote and expand and cultivate Buddhism in Japan. He sends a lot of expeditions, a lot of people to China in order to bring things back to cultivate them, to make them established in Japan, including things like texts, including things like various ritual activity, and actually physically monks from China to come in and to teach people. And so the Chinese influence on Japanese Buddhism would be very strong in these early years because of this. And here now, making a huge leap in time and in space, but in the space, at least, I hope can make some sense, is that we can get to Buddhism in America. A lot of Buddhism in America comes via China and Japan. A lot of the early Buddhism in America that we see comes via China and Japan. And there are just numerous ways you could talk about Buddhism arriving over here on the shores of this country. I'll just give you a few. Early 19th century, we see a number of Chinese immigrants coming who practice a variety of forms of Mahayana Buddhism, not just one, but a variety of them, coming into the west coast of the United States. And then with the gold rush, there's a huge push, a big push of Chinese immigrants coming in search of, like anybody who was going out for the gold rush, looking for a little prosperity. So that's the mid-19th century. 1853 is usually recognized as the very first Buddhist temple in San Francisco. It was established. It was a Chinese American fraternal order called the Seiz Yap Company. By around the early 20th century, there along the West Coast, there were roughly 400 Chinese Buddhist temples. Not just Buddhists, but actually elements of Taoism and Buddhism in these sort of fraternal order houses that were referred to as Joss houses. And here's one that's been preserved apparently in Weatherville Joss House. It's in a state park, Weatherville State Park, I think it's called. in California. It's a very small, sort of little cabin-looking thing, but inside you can see there's lots of Buddhist ornamentation and so on. Yeah.
Is joss a term for for incense?
Joss sticks are incense sticks. Joss is a derivation of Deus, the Portuguese word for God. Mm. So God house, I guess we would call this, and God sticks in that case for the incense sticks. Some intellectual foundations for Buddhism in America. Translations are critical wherever Buddhism's going. You can't move the you can't move the ideas. The people can't, you know, share their ideas unless there's a point in which people can talk the same language. So translations are critical from the very first day. Various people from China come into India early on, go to some of the Buddhist universities in India, and they learn how to translate texts. Have you ever read the story Journey to the West?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the whole story is about an important Buddhist monk traveling from China into the Himalaya, into the northern India, in order to collect Sanskrit manuscripts to bring them back. And it's a legend, but it's based on a true story of the monk Xuanzang, and he brings back all of these manuscripts from Sanskrit and Pali, brings them to China, and he starts a translation school. It happens everywhere. You can't have that. You can't have Buddhism take root here in the United States either, unless you have translations. And early 19th century is when we start seeing a proliferation of translations in French and English and in German, thanks to the British colonizers in South Asia. In particular, they gave us a lot of the translations that we had early on. Same with the French; they had a small but an important occupation in South Asia too, and of course in Southeast Asia. And then the German Orientalists also opened up a lot of Buddhist ideas to us. Mid-19th century in New England, northeastern America, the Transcendentalists took a particularly keen interest in Buddhism. So folks like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Margaret Fuller, and that list could go on. You probably maybe have some favorite authors and artists from the Transcendental period. They were very influential in bringing Buddhist ideas to the American scene. They were very influential in bringing the notion of nature to represent an important part of Buddhism in the American community. In particular, putting that sort of pride of place. Emerson and Thoreau edited and co-published a journal called The Dial, and in 1844 they gave an English translation of the Lotus Sutra. This is a very early edition of an important Buddhist text in America. 1893, the World's Parliament of Religions was also very, very critical to bringing Buddhism to the shores or to the U.S., the land of the United States. The World's Parliament of Religions was really an effort to bring tolerance to all people internationally, right? Bring representatives from the world's religions, not just Buddhism, but Hinduism and Zoroastrianism and Judaism and Christianity and the Orthodox version and the, you know, all versions that you could find from around the world came, and they sort of settled on the Midway in Hyde Park in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, and various people gave lectures about their traditions. A Zen master named Soyan Shaku and a Sri Lankan monk named Dharmapala had an especially profound impact on a lot of people and gained some converts almost immediately. So I'm forgetting his name. It might be Charles T. something was a Jewish American who converted to Buddhism almost immediately after hearing Dharmapala give his talk. And so he's often recognized as, might be Russell or Simmons, or I might just be confusing Russell Simmons because he's not somebody that is an actual person. And Dharmapala converted him right there and gave him a mantra to say as a part of his conversion to Buddhism. Of course, later on, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, we've got American servicemen and women going abroad into countries where Buddhism is very important and popular, and they're bringing things back, material culture of the religion, but also families in some cases. And the Tibetan, after 1959, when the Tibetans are leaving Tibet, settling in northern India, a lot of them were also immigrating outside of Asia, and many came here to the United States. And then we have in the 50s and 60s, Zen and Chan, which is the Chinese version of Zen. Buddhism gained a lot of popularity in this country thanks to kind of literati, artists, community, folks that maybe we all know. D.T. Suzuki was very important for a kind of scholarly application of Buddhism in a popular language that people could understand, but there were others as well, including Alan Watts, who did the same sort of approach. And then there were folks like Philip Kaplow, who's fitting in that period, which is why we're all here today, of course. And then there were more literary types like Gary Snyder, poet, Kerouac, Ginsberg, and a lot of others who we associate with the Beat generation. This is where I end my course with my students, as we end up reading Dharma Bums. We just finished that last week. We came here, in fact, as part of the sort of study of American Buddhism. We were all here last week, sitting in the Zendo. And that's where I'm going to stop now, because my head's starting to spin. For me. You can ask questions or comments. I'd be happy to hear your comments, too, because I'm sure there are plenty of things that you all can say about Buddhism's movement that I haven't mentioned.
You haven't said anything about Europe.
I haven't said anything about Europe. I haven't said anything about Russia. There's a large population of Buddhists in Russia, for example. There's a large population of Buddhists in Europe too. Yeah, Europe would have a direct link, for example, to some of the colonial expositions of the British colonial, the Dutch colonial work in Southeast Asia, the French as well. Bringing their texts back and opening up notions of that. And we inherit a lot of it from Europe as well, not directly necessarily from China and Japan, but we get it from Europe. German philosophers were very important to making Buddhism prevalent to the American culture as well, Schopenhauer being one example, but there are many, many others too. Yeah.
Any remark about the fate of the Buddhist early missions to Athens and Antioch?
With the Ashokan from that map? Not sure what to say. I don't, in part because I don't know what to say, actually. I'm not sure what to say. Ashoka's efforts to push the Dharma that far certainly happened. You see interactions also with Greek explorers coming into India, for example, and encountering Buddhism. Megasthenes has a wonderful travelogue, I guess we'd call it, where he comes into South Asia and he experiences the various religious practitioners and so on and brings that information back. But I'm not sure exactly what to say in terms of if you're asking why they didn't become prominent or something. I don't have an answer to that.
Who they might have encountered.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah.
Are there any traces left in Afghanistan, Pakistan, that area?
There's a wonderful movie called The Giant Buddhas about these two humongous Buddhas that were in Afghanistan that were obliterated, blown up with TNT by the Taliban as an effort to get rid of religious imagery that is anathema in the Islam, tradition of Islam that they practice there. And so there was a very wide effort once Islam starts taking root in that part of the world to denude it of religious iconography, including Buddhism. There are plenty of places, museums and so on around the world that have preserved some statues and so on, but they're not in situ where they were originally created. And so some of our earliest sculptures of the Buddha, to get an idea of what people imagine the Buddha to look like, Gautama, come from Pakistan or that region of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and often has a mustache, in fact, which is you don't see in other parts of other images of him. But there's not a lot, sort of remaining in its natural area because of that efforts of Islam.
There's a museum in Pasadena, the Norton Simon, that has a collection of a Buddhist collection, and a number of the figures are from what's now Afghanistan.
Yeah, and that was a very important point on the Silk Road, right? Gandhara is the area that is referred to. where we find some of the greatest transmission of things east and west. And so some of those early Buddhist ideas and images from that part of the world end up traveling out of there, and you find them all around east and west of the location because of that.
You mentioned a lot of texts in Sanskrit. I was curious how quickly the texts switched languages from, or were being written or spoken from Pali to Sanskrit. The baskets, were those originally in Sanskrit or Pali?
Pali, right. And so the canon, Pali canon,
oh, the Pali, of course, yeah.
It refers to the language, the canon in the Pali language. And then you have as Buddhism, as you get these divergences in those 18 early schools, mm-hmm. and then of course as Buddhism moves from this conservative notion, you see the proliferation of literature in other languages, primarily Sanskrit at this time, you know, in the turn around the Common Era, the centuries before and the centuries after. Vernacular languages become harder and harder to find in that time, but as time progresses, you start finding them in other languages too, especially as you get outside of India, right? And so you have a Chinese canon. It's not a Pali canon, it's a Chinese canon. You have a Tibetan canon as well. It's the Tibetan-Mongolian canon, written in Tibetan, however. And so you see that too.
Can you confirm whether the early Buddhist councils practiced democratic organization?
In terms of everybody voting on something and...
Or rules of order. I read of an assertion that early Buddhist communities preserved democratic methods from the, from pre-existing Gautama. That the kingdoms there were both a mix of republics and kingdoms.
So in the Second Buddhist Council, for example, that council was convened because of an accusation by a prominent monk of one sangha allowing its members to receive money, and they were handling money. And so the Second Council was called as a way to figure out whether people were adhering to the second basket, the code of conduct, the Vinaya basket. And what happens is basically the way it's described is a kind of trial, and there's a jury. And so there's somebody who's conducting each one of these councils, who's conducting this trial, but it goes to a kind of vote. The Sangha, who's in attendance at that time, however, was the first one was about 500, they say. The second one was about twice as much. So it wasn't everybody voting yay or nay on that, but there was a jury. And how the jury was selected, I don't know. It's a good question, though. But there was a sense of a kind of definitely not something that would be handed down, or ruling was not handed down because of one person, senior monk or something like that, making the decision. It was something that was ruled by a committee.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.